Big changes in the Middle East could set the stage for a ceasefire deal in Gaza.
Urgency was the one thing that's been missing from these negotiations and why there hasn't been a deal.
I'm Carol Hills. Today, prospects for peace after 18 months of war. And the latest on a U.S. delegation to Damascus to meet with Syria's de facto new leaders. Meanwhile, in Belgium, a kerfuffle over language.
You have to speak Dutch in Flanders and French in Wallonia, but in Brussels, it's a bit complicated because it's a bilingual region.
Just don't lose track of where you are on a moving train. Plus, Singapore is requiring a fancy GPS tool in cars, and it's not cheap.
It tracks your speed, your distance travel daily, and they're going to charge you for it. Yeah.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being here this Friday. It's been less than 2 weeks since the Assad regime collapsed in Syria, but the celebrations continue. Meanwhile, the political developments are coming in fast and furious. There's already a de facto leadership in place in Damascus. It's made up of members of the Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS, rebel group. And today, the U.S. State Department's top Middle East envoy, Barbara Leaf, arrived in Damascus to meet with the interim authorities. After that meeting, the Biden administration announced it's called off a $10 million reward for the capture of the HTS leader. Though at this point, the group remains designated as a foreign terrorist organization. Ibrahim Al-Asil joined me earlier from Damascus to discuss Leaf's visit to the Syrian capital. He's a non-resident senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington.
What I could expect that they discussed from their previous meetings, because I know they also met with civil society groups, they met with journalists, and they were emphasizing about the need for a national dialogue and for the Syrian government to be representative and to respect the rights of Syrians. And from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham perspective, what they really care about is being delisted from terrorism list and also for the sanctions to be lifted. If that does not happen, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham will be in deep trouble because the economic situation inside Syria is really dire.
So who makes the decision about lifting sanctions against Syria?
That's a great question, because there are different groups and categories of sanctions on Syria. There are sanctions by the international community, not only by the United States, and there are multiple sanctions by the United States, some of them related to the behavior of the regime towards its own citizens. Some of it is about sponsoring terrorism. Some of it is about its policy towards the United States and its allies. So in the United States, some of them, I think, could be relieved through some temporary exemptions. But to lift all sanctions, that's not only up to the president, that also needs an approval from the Congress. But also over the last couple of weeks, we've heard different Congress members expressing that they are willing to lift sanctions if they see that the government, the current government in Damascus today, is interested in building an inclusive government and be open to other components of Syrian society.
Do you have the sense that there's kind of a checklist that this de facto government in Syria has to comply with before sanctions are lifted? Or do you think it's more sort of squishy than that?
Yes, I think there are some items. Some of them are related to their position towards the region and the world. And for that, Hayat Tahrir al-Sham has assured all European delegations and the U.S. delegation and everyone they meet with, like also Western journalists, that they do want peaceful relations with their neighbors in the region and with the world. They do not want to be in war or in conflict with anyone. But then there are also items related to the domestic situation, and mainly that to be inclusive, to be open to other components inside Syria. Currently, the situation makes holding elections in Syria almost impossible. There is no infrastructure. There are millions of people in camps. They are displaced. However, holding a national conference for a national dialogue could, for the moment, be sufficient to at least show they are open and they are inclusive. They are allowing other components of Syrian society to participate and they are willing to share power.
Do you have any sense that Israel may have come up today in these conversations?
That's possible. And I would assume that Hayat Tahrir al-Sham said what they've been saying to Western journalists, that they do not want to be in conflict with Israel, but the Israeli attacks on Syria and occupying further territories, not only in the buffer zone, they occupy the buffer zone and they went further outside the buffer zone. That's really concerning because we haven't seen any messages from Syria, from Hayat Tahrir al-Sham or even other groups for anyone calling for aggression against Israel. To the contrary to that, most people now say, we don't want to be in conflicts. We want to solve any problem we have through talks and peacefully with all our neighbors. And I think the United States could play a constructive role here by assuring Israel that there's no need for that and try to open some talks between them and Damascus to de-escalate that and limit of the military operation that's happening now.
Ibrahim, I have to ask, you haven't been able to return to Damascus, which is your hometown, since the start of the uprising in Syria. How does it feel to be there?
It feels, you know, it's very emotional. And there are some feelings you can't put in words. To some point, it's overwhelming. There is being back home after 13 years to walk around Damascus and to see people celebrating the fall of a regime that, by the way, wasn't only for 23 years, the rule of Bashar al-Assad. His father was there before him. It's more than five decades of oppression. People are relieved, but they also know there is a lot of challenges coming up in the future. But they are hopeful and they hope that the worst days are behind them now.
That was Ibrahim Al-Asil speaking to us from Damascus. He's an adjunct professor at George Washington University. Mexico is known for its murals, from wall paintings made by indigenous people to frescoes left by Spanish colonizers. And of course, the famous murals by artists like Diego Rivera are a huge draw in Mexico City. Now the government is turning to murals as a way to transform struggling communities. The World's Tipisaya reports from Mexico City on what officials say has become the largest mural project in the world.
Iztapalapa feels like a city within a city. With close to 2 million residents, it's the most populous district of Mexico City, and it's also the poorest. Residents here often experience water shortages and are exposed to high levels of pollution as well as crime. But walking down some of the streets of Iztapalapa feels like visiting an exhibition of street art.
¿Este es el sendero de minas? Es una de las avenidas principales, ¿no? De las vías.
Pedro Peña, also known as Micron, is one of the 150 artists recruited by the local government to do these murals, and he takes me on a walking tour.
Te mentiría una cifra de murales, pero hicimos bastantes. Muchísimos hicimos.
He says he can't even remember how many walls he's painted here. But in total, over 11,000 murals have been created by these artists over 5 years. That's the largest mural project in the world, according to the local government. The murals are on public buildings, private businesses and homes, even on rooftops visible from cable cars. And they depict local stories, traditions, characters and neighbors from the area.
Y de aquel lado hay un mural que realicé yo, que se hizo muy viral en redes sociales.
Micron points to one of his murals which became viral on social media.
La escena que muestra, pues este señor.
It shows two elderly residents and longtime lovers who were frequently seen in the area, the man guiding his wife in a wheelchair. Micron also portrayed the man who collects garbage in the neighborhood or the woman who kneads the dough at the bakery. The Iztapalapa mural project started as a push to improve the lives of women in an area where femicides remain a big issue.
Entonces se dota de iluminación, de cerillos muy iluminado.
María Antonieta Pérez Orozco, former executive director of the city of Iztapalapa, says the security strategy involved the installation of hundreds of street lights and the deployment of police officers, but also to embellish the streets with murals. Many depict working women or show messages like stop violence or if he hits you, he doesn't love you.
Al principio no querían murales.
Orozco says that at first people didn't want murals because they didn't trust the street artists to do a good job. But now,
la gente quiere un mural, quiere un mural.
They are requesting murals, just like 8-year-old Luciana Daniel recently did.
Esta soy yo. Y que está enfrente de mi casa y que soy yo porque
this is me, she says. After the parents agreed, Micron painted her wearing an astronaut suit.
Uno de mis sueños es ir a la luna, entonces por eso me puse este.
Because, she explains, one of her dreams is to go to the moon.
Tiene mucha hermosura. Yo digo, no puedo creer que soy yo enfrente de mi casa.
It's so beautiful, she says. I can't believe it's me in front of my house. Micron says the mural sends an aspirational message to other girls in the barrio. Luciana's mom, Carmen Solís, says the murals have changed the face of the place.
Pues yo creo que ha cambiado mucho y se ha notado demasiado porque
everything was gray and dull, and now it's colorful and bright, she says. And also, as a woman, she says she feels safer walking down the streets of Iztapalapa. Micron and his colleagues have now moved to a different part of the city where they hope to do a similar intervention. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
If you're in the UK and looking for a pint of Guinness down at the pub, good luck. The popular Dublin Stout has been in high demand in recent months. Now there's a shortage. It was a pub in Belfast, Northern Ireland, that raised the alarm late last month.
There's going to be a shortage of Guinness coming up to Christmas, coming into December.
That's John Biddles, owner of Biddles Bar, talking to the Irish Times.
So it seemed to be that there is going to be a shortage of kegs and a general shortage of Guinness.
Diageo distributes Guinness, and the company says worldwide sales of the signature stout were up 20% this year and that orders were outstripping production. This pub owner in London saw the signs.
I do my normal weekly orders every Monday, and normally I'd order 7 or 8 barrels, and this Monday when I went to do my orders, there were only 4 available to me.
To preserve the precious brew, Kate Davis of the Old Ivy House turned to rationing. She even printed up a card for her customers.
It says, in these difficult times of Guinness rationing, we require our beloved patrons to purchase 2 other drinks before they can buy their ration of Guinness.
The shortage has brought on finger-pointing.
I think now, recently, it is social media must have had an effect. The Gen Z got hold of it.
In this video, pop star Olivia Rodrigo wears a Guinness is good for you t-shirt on stage in Dublin. Then there's Kim Kardashian, who posts selfies drinking Guinness all over social media. Even the Princess of Wales, Kate Middleton, can be seen hoisting a pint with Prince William online. These influencers are credited with a boost in Guinness drinking among young women. And then there's this other social media phenomenon.
Splitting the G.
I've had to go and split the G on the Guinness.
I split the G, and it was the biggest single viewed video on my page.
It's a drinking game. You take an official Guinness pint glass emblazoned with the trademark harp and the word Guinness. You chug just enough that when you set down your glass, the top of the liquid is centered on the letter G in the word Guinness. Consumer research firm GWI determined that up to last year, Guinness was most popular with 55 to 64-year-olds. Now it's 25 to 35-year-olds who drink it most. That metric really bothers Howard Thomas, a 60-something patron of London's Old Ivy House.
Stop young people drinking Guinness and there won't be this problem. Let the old people, before they go, let them have a drop of Guinness. It might keep them alive longer.
Meanwhile, Guinness promises to have production up by January in time for the Guinness Six Nations rugby tournament.
Hi, I'm Patrick Nguyen, the world's correspondent in Bangkok. And wow, what a year. I've reported on North Korean hackers infiltrating American hospitals and military bases, continued violence against the Rohingya in Myanmar, and get this, an island called Bougainville that may soon be the next newest country on Earth. These stories are about real people facing extraordinary challenges, and they're not getting nearly enough attention. At The World, we believe in journalism that goes beyond the surface to show the human side of global events. And we're connecting the dots, showing you how decisions in Washington can have a big effect on events here in Southeast Asia, and vice versa, so you can see the bigger picture. In-depth reporting isn't easy. We can't do it without our listeners' support. As a nonprofit newsroom, we depend on listeners like you to help fund our work. Your donations pay for travel, measures to keep us safe in the field, and everything else me and my colleagues need to bring stories to life. We're quickly nearing the end of the year and our fundraising drive, and right now we have a great opportunity. A generous donor has pledged to match every donation one-to-one until December 31st, so your gift would go twice as far. If you value thoughtful, independent journalism that puts real people at the center of every story, please consider making a donation today. No amount is too small. Every dollar makes a difference. Please visit theworld.org/give to make a gift. That's theworld.org/give. Thanks so much.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Language is a very touchy thing in Belgium. Say you're at a train station in the Belgian capital of Brussels. On the platform, you'll hear announcements in French.
Voie 1, le train S8 à destination de Bruxelles midi de 14h.
And in Dutch.
De S8 train naar Brussels uit van 14.
But once your train leaves Brussels, the conductor better know which language they're supposed to use for official announcements, because outside of the capital, the law requires them to use either French or Dutch, depending on what part of Belgium they're in. And that law can be enforced. Conductor Ilias Alba recently learned that the hard way when he greeted passengers in French and in Dutch. Maite Cheny is a reporter with the Brussels Times.
What's happened here is that a conductor basically was 2 minutes outside of Brussels in the Dutch-speaking region, so had to speak Dutch, but greeted his passengers in both French and Dutch, which is apparently a problem because one passenger apparently filed a complaint against him.
Wow. And so just to be clear for our listeners, you know, Belgium is in many ways a sort of a country divided by language. There's the French part, the Walloon part, and then there's the Flemish part where people speak Dutch. So you say there's these laws about when a conductor can use these languages. Why is this taken so seriously?
Historically, Belgium has been very sensitive about its languages because Dutch speakers in Belgium have always been in the minority. So there are some language laws that protect their rights to be helped and served in their own language. And now this is kind of putting that under fire.
Maite, I was reading into this and I was sort of confused because there's even laws about what order you use the language as a conductor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so when you're on a train in Belgium, you have to speak Dutch in Flanders and French in Wallonia. But in Brussels, it's a bit complicated because it's a bilingual city region. And if the conductor who is in charge of the train at the moment is himself or herself a native French speaker, he has to start his announcement in French and then he can do it in Dutch. And if he himself is a Dutch speaker, he has to start in Dutch and then can do it in French.
So do you speak both French and Dutch?
Yes, but native French speakers will very clearly hear that I am not a native French speaker. But I have learned French at school, yes.
And of course, you speak English fluently, too.
Yeah.
So, as we mentioned, you're from the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, but you now live in Brussels. How practical are these laws in your everyday life?
They are very... The laws are there on paper, but practically, I don't really benefit from them, you could say. So, technically, when I'm in Brussels, I should be able to be helped by the government in Dutch, because I am a native Dutch speaker. And I could, if I really wanted to and had time and money to kind of chase them up on it, but they just tend to do everything in French because that's still the majority language here.
So this language division has been around since the 19th century. Is it slowly eroding or is it just kind of holding fast?
It's certainly holding. But I do think with the rise of English, it's kind of helping, because when you are in mixed company, like with Flemish and Walloon people, which language you choose to speak is kind of politically loaded, because someone will always have to adapt. But when you choose English, everyone can kind of see that as a neutral language. So I think the division between Dutch and French is going to stay there, but maybe English will help us a little.
So are you going to pay closer attention next time you're on a train to what language the conductor is speaking?
I'm usually on this train line where this happens, and I've never actually paid really close attention. It is just once I hear French, I think, I'm almost at my stop. But I must confess that I've never thought, oh no, we're still 1 minute outside of Brussels. How dare he? So.
Maite Chini is a reporter with the Brussels Times. Turkey with stuffing, cookies, Christmas pudding, maybe some eggnog. There's plenty of tasty holiday stuff to get excited about. But in Britain, what many people find truly mouthwatering is an elaborate cake from northern Italy, as Leo Hornack first reported from London last Christmas.
At Carluccio's Deli, inside St Pancras Station in London, the choice of Christmas cakes is definitely varied.
We have a panettone tradizionale, we have a chocolate panettone, we have a panettone al cappuccino.
But it does help if you really like a cake called panettone.
We have a panettone al limoncello. We do a smaller Milano panettone, which is the real first panettone from Milan. I'm thinking what you might like is our limited edition panettone that we have done with gin experts Malfi.
Jamie Wood is the buyer for Carluccio's, one of the biggest Italian deli chains in the country. And if you are new to the wonder of the panettone, you could just say it's a light, fluffy fruit cake from Milan eaten at Christmas. But Jamie will tell you, that's skipping over a lot. He still remembers his first slice.
Like nothing I'd ever tasted before. Quite frankly, I would never go back to another Christmas cake. Completely sold, completely in love from day one.
In its traditional form, picture a beautiful dome-shaped dark brown cake with an airy dough infused with raisins and candied fruit. According to legend, it was invented by a baker called Antonio to impress his boss's daughter. The name panettone translating as Tony's bread. And over the last few years, Britain's become infatuated with this glamorous Italian import. One of the big supermarkets here, Selfridges, says that it now sells twice as much panettone as traditional British Christmas cake. There is one strange element to our new obsession. We don't know how to make them. Almost every other foreign delicacy that Britain has adopted is regularly attempted by British bakeries. Parisian croissants, Danish pastries, Portuguese pastel de nata. But almost no professional British bakery offers a locally made panettone. Almost every panettone for sale is imported from Italy. So what do Milan's bakers know that we don't?
Shall I open the oven then? Yes, please.
Okay, all right. There we go. I do know someone who might be able to bridge the cultural divide. Years ago, my father Angelo used to bake panettone as a Christmas treat.
I like them toasted very much.
He grew up in London, but his father was Italian, and my dad's early childhood memories are of visiting London's few Italian delis in the early 1950s, trying to locate authentic spaghetti and tomato sauce. Most British people back then weren't interested in Italian food.
It wasn't very popular, and people still thought spaghetti grew on trees.
So I asked my father to dust off the panettone recipe he used for home baking, to crack the code. Turns out there's a reason he hasn't made one for a while.
To do it properly is a multi-stage operation.
Yes.
3 hours to do this, wait another 3 hours, do this, another 3 hours. So doing all those things is a full-time job.
In fact, a standard recipe takes a full 48 hours to complete. It even involves hanging the cake upside down for a spell so it doesn't collapse in on itself. All that might explain why British people still prefer to leave it to the Italians. But 2 days after my dad started, a pair of homemade panettone are ready in front of us. The family recipe revived.
Oh, it's exciting.
They smell amazing. The vanilla and the fruits are coming through.
I'm going to eat a bit of it.
We've also opened up a store-bought panettone to compare. We are, of course, completely objective judges.
Yeah, it's nice. It's got a good texture.
I think this one is a bit more subtle, if I might say.
Oh, you can, yes.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack in London. Buon Natale e buone feste.
Christmas lights are pretty, no argument there, but they may not pass the necessity test for scientists warning of the dangers of light pollution.
Before you install a light, the question should be, who is the light for and what do they need?
Plus, justice at the arcade in Hong Kong, where they're regulating the claw. Ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The tectonic plates of diplomacy in the Middle East have been shifting in a major way lately. There's the abrupt end of the Assad regime in Syria, and now peace talks between Israel and Hamas are sounding more promising. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan had a simple explanation when he recently discussed the deal.
We believe Hamas was waiting for lots of other actors and forces to come to their rescue, to come to their aid.
But no one came to Hezbollah's aid in Lebanon, and the group signed on to a ceasefire deal with Israel. And Sullivan thinks that changed Hamas's calculus.
And we believe that it puts us in a position to be able to close this negotiation.
Aaron David Miller was a negotiator for the U.S. State Department between Israel and the Palestinians in the 90s and aughts, and he's been following the peace talks. Aaron, a true ceasefire deal in Gaza would be remarkable after 18 months of war and major civilian loss. So what are the outlines of the current agreement? What's happened to kind of push this forward now?
I mean, you know, urgency, Carol, is the one thing that's been missing from these negotiations and why there hasn't been a deal. Hezbollah has been hollowed out. The Iranians are retrenching. Hamas also has nothing to show for a year of misery inflicted on the people of Gaza because of the prosecution of Israel's war in an effort to root out Hamas fighters. And then there's the question of what Hamas gets in return. Hamas has to show something, and what they want to show are an asymmetrical number of Palestinian prisoners returned, limited withdrawal of Israelis during the ceasefire from specific areas of Gaza, and then the return of displaced Palestinians to northern Gaza. And the Israelis have their own views on all three of these issues.
I was going to ask, what's in this for Israel? What are they willing to do at this point?
I think the Israeli Defense Forces understand that the war against Hamas has been concluded. And the fact is, the Israelis need a break. They want to refocus their attention on Iran. And the prime minister, who has balked at a deal for any number of reasons, I think is under growing pressure, not just from the hostage families, but also from the logic of the situation. There's very little that the IDF needs to continue to do in Gaza. They destroyed Hamas as an organized military organization. Now it's the question of denying Hamas a political victory. So hostages come home. A limited ceasefire, 6 weeks. And then, of course, there's Mr. Netanyahu's relationship with the incoming president, who has spoken out about the need, the importance, the urgency of getting a deal. I think the prime minister would like to clear the decks, at least for a limited deal, so he can persuade the incoming president about what he really wants to do, which is to find a way to continue to weaken Iran and to destroy its nuclear sites. So better chance than ever, I would say, for a deal. But again, my experience, Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, they really only have two speeds, slow and slower.
Has the Biden administration had any role in these latest negotiations?
Yeah, I think they're pushing it.
If somehow you could be in the room whispering in people's ears on both sides of the negotiating table, what would you say?
I'd say this is the worst crisis that Israelis and Palestinians have faced in the history of their conflict. Israelis and Palestinians have suffered enough. And this conflict represents the lowest point of their relationship. It's time to look beyond it and try to begin to create another pathway forward, which would not only end the suffering and trauma of both sides, but begin to look at a resolution of this conflict. And the only durable, equitable solution to this conflict will be, at some point, separation through negotiations. The emergence of a Palestinian state living alongside of the state of Israel in peace and security. I realize that sounds like a wishful thinking, but it is the only alternative that is going to end this conflict. And Israelis and Palestinians need to begin to focus on the long road back that would produce such an outcome.
Aaron David Miller was a negotiator for the U.S. State Department between Israel and the Palestinians in the 90s and aughts. In lots of towns, there's a neighborhood or even just a particular house that's famous for its Christmas lights. And people come from miles around to take in the dazzling spectacle of all the blinking, multicolored illumination. That is a seasonal phenomenon, but ecologists have long warned about the everyday problem of light pollution.
Before you install a light, the question should be, who is it for? There's no one answer for exactly what you should do. It's very context dependent. But it always should start with this question, who is the light for and what do they need?
That's Chris Kaiba. He's a physicist and light pollution detective at Ruhr University in Germany. And he uses satellite imagery to zero in on how excess light is affecting specific patches of land. By some estimations, light pollution has gone up by at least 49% since the 1990s. And the problem is especially bad in Europe. Our partners Deutsche Welle had Chris Kaiba on the podcast Living Planet take journalist Kathleen Schuster on a walking tour of light pollution in Cologne, Germany.
What exactly is the problem with light pollution when it comes to our environment?
So when life evolved, it had a regular switch from daytime to nighttime. And that was really important for early life to adapt to that. And for hundreds of millions of years, we had sort of the same conditions all the time. And now all of a sudden, the light environment at night is completely different from the way it was during this entire evolutionary period. And so that really throws a lot of organisms for a loop.
Chris has been working together with an animal ecologist named Dr. Jana Eckert on these questions of light pollution and biodiversity. Jana works at the University of Potsdam outside of Berlin and says if you want to know how we are impacting insects with our lights, just look at your regular black beetles.
My interest in beetles was triggered with these little LED garden lights. They are put to places where you need a bit light to see the step in your garden, or you want to illuminate the path. And these are usually these little garden lights that illuminate the ground. And I was wondering what all these animals that walk on the ground, whether or not they are affected by this small garden lights. And until recently, the gardens and the parks in our cities were the dark refuges for all these little night creatures. And now suddenly you can buy these LED lights everywhere and people just put them out everywhere. If you now walk through Berlin and look at the gardens, they look completely different. They have all these little light sources everywhere. And this is a new threat to all the animals on the ground.
Jana and her team placed solar-powered LED garden lamps in a dark sky reserve outside Berlin to see how beetles would respond. They found two main results. One, there were some beetles that gathered around the light and got stuck. This is a common problem with insects and means that they're more likely to be eaten by spiders, toads, and bats. The other outcome was that some of the beetles avoided the light altogether and reduced their nighttime activity. And in both cases, this echoes a general concern that distracted insects stop doing what they do best: foraging and mating. And this can ultimately reduce their population size and have widespread knock-on effects.
Because they eat pests. They eat caterpillars, they eat all kinds of other herbivorous beetles, or other beetles that eat plants. So they are active at night and eat lots of things that you don't want to have in your garden. So that could be a straight impact because the food chain is changed. And in this case, the group of animals that control other animals is affected.
Another knock-on effect that researchers want to prevent is the impact on nocturnal pollinators, like moths. Authors of a study from the UK in 2020 have pointed out moths that pollinate at night could help stabilize agricultural ecosystems at a time when daytime pollinators, like bees, are dying out. Jana says animals farther up the food chain, like voles, are being affected too. And if you need something to brighten your day, do yourself a favor and Google this animal. It's like a mouse, but cuter. One impact she and her team found was that artificial light and sky glow made the voles shift their foraging activities from the night to the daytime.
We don't see that much biodiversity, partly because a huge proportion of biodiversity is active at night. Some people say more than 60% of the insects are nocturnal. So we underestimate activity of nocturnal animals. We underestimate how important they are. We underestimate their biodiversity, and we massively disturb it with artificial light at night.
The park Chris and I are walking through is almost entirely absent of any lights. Would you say this is a very good example of what things should be like?
So when we think about urban planning, we really need to think holistically about everyone, the people who live there and the environment. In Germany, it's very typical that most of the parks are not illuminated, and these are very important refuges for urban animals. In certain cases, it may make sense if you have a very high use of people and you want to encourage more people to use a park, that you illuminate that park. But in the sort of holistic city planning, you don't illuminate every park.
So, you know, it's nice and dark here, but does it make that big of a difference if there are small pockets of space that are kind of more protective for biodiversity? Or is it kind of like, well, there's such a large scale problem, this is just, you know, a drop in the bucket?
No, I think it really does matter, actually, for the parks to be not illuminated. But the distance that some insects and other organisms travel is not really large. And if you're thinking, for example, also of a bird that nests in a nest they built in the tree, it's going to be a really big difference whether that light is, like here in our case, it's maybe 50 or 100 meters away, to if the light is right in the park, in terms of, you know, how they sleep in their nest. So having these pockets of darkness, I think, really is actually important for biodiversity. And in Europe, there's a little bit of a movement to try to link these dark things in the same way that we try to create green corridors for animals to navigate through the environment, also to create dark corridors so that animals that are active at nighttime have a way to move around through the environment.
Eventually, the bright lights of the city draw us back in. Chris wants to check out an LED hotspot he saw in his aerial photos. It's a soccer field, but whether the lighting is good or bad remains to be seen.
One of the things that we see here is that we're standing almost directly beneath one of the lights, and it is not glaring, and we're standing in a really moderate amount of light, because this is a highly asymmetric light. It's shining its light on the field, and it is trying to avoid shining it onto the surrounding areas. Sports lighting can be really, really problematic, especially for neighbors. Even up to a kilometer away, it can be really, really problematic if you're not maintaining the light in the sports area. This is the kind of world we're imagining. You still have the illumination, you're still able to use the sports field, but you're really reducing the amount of light that's going into the environment.
Thinking about, you know, what could a city look like with less lighting or a different kind of lighting, it's kind of in contrast to what we think of as a modern city, which is, you know, city lights.
In a place like Times Square, there are actually clear rules about how bright the signs are allowed to be. It's not just anything goes. Yeah, so ideally, when we're looking at a city from far away, this image of the twinkling lights of the city is not going to be there anymore, because the light's going to stay inside the city. It's not going to reach the hills far away anymore. But for the people who are in the city, it shouldn't seem dark. The whole idea is that we're trying to create spaces that work well for people while not illuminating the places where the nature is. And so in your city center, you should still be able to have lit advertisements. You should still have sidewalks that you can walk on safely. But the idea is to keep that light there and not let it get into the surrounding areas.
That's Chris Kaiba, physicist and light pollution expert at Ruhr University, talking with Kathleen Schuster in Cologne, Germany, for the podcast Living Planet from our partners DW Deutsche Welle. As the holiday season settles in, sharing treats with friends and neighbors is a nice way to spread some joy. And in this next story, it's not just about sharing with a few friends and neighbors, but people throughout an entire city. Laura Ziegler of KCUR in Kansas City takes us inside an annual baklava-making extravaganza started by the Turkish-American community there.
In a small, nondescript building off Highway 635 in Shawnee, a half a dozen women are making baklava, pouring whole walnuts into a food processor, grinding them into tiny pieces.
You're not measuring. You just have eyeballing. Because you've done it so many times.
Marika Dalbudak is a volunteer with the Dialogue Institute of Kansas City, a chapter of a national organization started by Muslims of Turkish heritage in the 60s to promote intercultural and interfaith understanding. 10 years ago, they started an informal tradition of sharing baklava with a few of their neighbors and friends of other faiths who were celebrating their winter holidays. Today, the group distributes 400 boxes of the sweet treat across Metro Kansas City, touching some 1,000 people.
Yeah, now our next step is making baklava and baking baklava.
Sirpal Taslama is from Western Turkey, an English teacher who moved to Kansas City from Austin a decade ago. She's standing at the end of a long table where three volunteers are rolling tissue-thin pieces of phyllo dough onto cookie sheets. Dal Budak and the other women are covering those sheets with a generous layer of chopped nuts.
They are using walnut.
Yeah. Dal Budak stirs several sticks of butter over a low flame, while Mine Dogan scrapes the foam off with a spoon, leaving the liquid a silky yellow with the unmistakable aroma of clarified butter.
Taking that top part off just so you get the pure butter.
Yeah, pure butter.
Then they brush lots of that butter over the nut-filled pastry rolls until they glisten in the morning light.
Everything's better with butter.
Yes, we said the same, yeah.
Then the pans of buttery pastry go into the oven, about 20 minutes at 380 degrees. While we wait, we sit down to Turkish coffee and Turkish delight, a chewy homemade treat of pomegranate and nuts. Sirpal Taslama says their friends of other faiths host Ramadan dinners during the Islamic holiday season, so it's gratifying to return the gesture in December.
For example, we are celebrating the Christmas, Happy Holiday and Merry Christmas time. But for the Jewish friend, we are writing our cards Happy Hanukkah for them.
Then the tray of golden brown baklava comes out of the oven, saturating the room with fresh baked pastry smells.
Did you hear the sound? This crunchy one?
It's ready to be cut and cooled, bathed in light sugary syrup, and tasted.
So good.
We do together, you know, to this style. We do together. This is a teamwork, I think.
It's so delicious.
Come on in. May I take your coats?
A few days later, Dialogue Institute volunteers, Aisha Ghul and Serkan Balimas, are out delivering the baklava. Their first stop is the downtown apartment of Kristen Regal, Mark Wilkins, and their 20-month-old son, Philip.
We would like to offer you your little gift is baklava.
And
for the next hour or so, on this cold and dreary Saturday morning, they shared stories of the ordinary, what their growing up was like in Turkey, outside Buffalo or Topeka. They talked about their work, how life changes with kids, whether they're toddlers or teens. At one point, they were talking about Istanbul, where Aisha Ghul grew up, and how part of that city is in Europe and another part in Asia. It's a tourist attraction, Serkan said.
It's a bridge. Oh, it's a long bridge. Yeah. So, like, not anymore, but before, like on one side of the bridge, there was like a sign, welcome to Europe, on the other side, welcome to Asia. So,
oh my gosh!
Yeah. So it's the same city.
Sharing stories of a bridge in Istanbul and building a bridge between cultures in Kansas City. For The World, I'm Laura Ziegler, Kansas City.
More news still ahead here on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. In many countries, cars have gotten more expensive. You can thank global inflation for that. But nowhere on earth are vehicles as pricey as they are in Singapore, where white-collar workers might pay triple their yearly salary for a basic sedan. That's because the city-state's government jacks prices way up to discourage people from buying cars. The World's Patrick Nguyen reports on what it takes to get behind the wheel in Singapore.
When Arthur Wong hits an open stretch of road in his pearl-colored Toyota GR86 coupe, he guns it.
Whoosh!
Wong is test-driving the coupe for his YouTube channel, Khaki Speed Reviews.
I love it, man. Honestly speaking, okay, this one I feel like.
Wong is one of Singapore's best-known car lovers. When he's not gushing about cars online, he's selling them at his dealership.
When people come to me and you know, they're hunting for a certain car. I like the euphoria, you know, when they take delivery and the first time behind the wheel. That gives me a lot of satisfaction.
But man, do his customers pay a lot to reach that happy place. I ask him to compare the price of a new Honda Civic sports sedan in the U.S. and Singapore.
In the States, probably it's around 40-ish, 50,000 USD. In Singapore, it's in excess of around 300,000. Ouch, you know, you can buy a house in a lot of countries.
Much of that is government fees. And in a new development, Singaporeans are mandated to install a black box in their cars, a GPS device that reports back to the government.
So it's a new system. Put like a GPS tracker in your car. It tracks your speed, your distance traveled daily, and they're going to charge you Barilla, yeah.
Wong says it can charge you a toll based on where you go and how much you use your car. Singapore's radical interventions in the lives of motorists go back decades. Here's Zafar Momin, a professor at the National University of Singapore who focuses on automotive strategy. He says driving in the country was once a headache.
There used to be long snaking queues and congestion and all the typical issues that we see in like metropolitan cities.
Traffic in other Asian capitals, New Delhi, Bangkok, Manila, is a nightmare. 3-hour traffic jams, cities drowning in car exhaust. Singapore would be like that too, if it didn't intervene. Maybe worse, because it's small, smaller than New York City by area and full of 5 million people, and it's wealthy. People on average make more than most Westerners. So to keep everyone from buying a car, Singapore decided in the 90s that to buy one, drivers would have to first buy a certificate.
Without that, you can't own a car. And you can own it for 10 years. It has a shelf life. Then after 10 years, you're going to let go.
Today, that piece of paper costs nearly $70,000 US. It ensures most standard cars in Singapore cost about 6 times the cost in, say, the US. Of course, that makes some drivers treat their vehicles as precious. Like this guy, who appears too timid to pull his car into a tight parking space and scratch his ride.
Please move your car. Look, so many people waiting for you. There's more than enough space. Are you an idiot? There's more than enough space.
That's the driver getting scolded for blocking traffic. Everybody has a dash cam in Singapore, and many upload their interactions to social media. High fees make people protective of their cars, but Professor Momin says fees are what it takes to achieve a small miracle, a Southeast Asian metropolis where driving is enjoyable because there are so few cars on the road.
Traffic is actually pretty good. Traffic actually flows. It's not bad. So we count our blessings.
But he adds this only works because public transport in Singapore is such a dream. There are other ways to get from A to B. As for the new mandatory GPS device, Momin says it's pretty unique.
No such system, to my knowledge, exists around the world. I mean, it exists for like commercial vehicles and stuff.
Like in long-haul cargo trucks. Tracking everyday commuters, that's new. The government hopes the wealth of data it gains will help them manipulate traffic with even more precision. Officials add that their goal is not to invade people's privacy.
People in Singapore take it at face value, I suppose.
Arthur Wong, the car enthusiast, says Singaporean drivers will tolerate just about anything, even a clunky device on their dash that tracks their every move. His objection to the device is aesthetic.
It breaks the harmony of the cars, you know, interior, that's what I feel. But it can't be helped, yeah, so we have to move on.
It's all worth it, he says, when he takes his favorite car down his favorite stretch of highway, heading into downtown, the skyline shimmering on the horizon.
Well, I'll be driving my yellow-color BMW M4, and we're going to see, okay, the whole view of the whole city. Very cosmo, world-class landscaping, you know.
No traffic jams either. It's a sensation he can't really get by taking the bus. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
It is a universal truth at the arcade that the machine you can't stand is the machine you can't stay away from. The claw. You pump quarters into the machine to move a big silver claw in the futile hope of grabbing something plushy, like a stuffed animal. Don't even bother going for something slick. It'll slide right out. Well, in Hong Kong, they've got your back because it seems that the claw is something of an obsession. There are claw parlors in Hong Kong. In one such establishment, Cage Chan told the South China Morning Post that he spends about $130 a week on the claw. Chan says he knows people say the machines are just scams, but for him, it is a game of skill. Hong Kong's Consumer Council begs to differ. After receiving dozens of complaints from players, the council is mulling over new regulations. Because...
Are these claw machines rigged?
Yeah, I'm afraid to say the answer is yes. They are rigged.
This is Phil Edwards of Vox on Inside Edition with the validation we've all been waiting for. Vox investigated claw machines, and what do you know?
Maybe about one out of every 24 times, there'll be enough power sent to that claw. The rest of the time, you'll get that sort of weak, limp claw that most of us are familiar with.
The game operators can control that. Cage Chan remains unconvinced. He demonstrates a move he calls claw swinging, and it doesn't work. But he insists it will eventually. And because some of the toys are collector's items, he'll recoup his losses. So he says this isn't just a way to claw money out of people's pockets. If you say so, buddy. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. Join us right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From P-